Well, hello everybody. Today I'd like to welcome Dr. Elliot Bowen to the show. Elliot is an assistant professor of history at Nazarbayev University in Astana, Kazakhstan. His research revolves around the relationship between medicine and sexuality, and he is the author of In Search of Sexual Health, Diagnosing and Treating Syphilis in Hot Springs, Arkansas, 1890-1940, which is new from Johns Hopkins University Press, and we'll be talking about that in just a sec. But before we get things going, let me appeal to your better judgment by asking that you head over to theroguehistorian.com, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to such things. And you can also follow me on Twitter at @mkeithharris and Instagram at @keithharrishistory. Well, okay, let's welcome Elliot to the show. Elliot, it is really awesome to have you on the show, man. Looking forward to talking to you. How you doing?
I am doing okay. We're just at the end of the semester here, so kind of wrapping up grading.
In Kazakhstan, of all places.
In Kazakhstan.
I think you are the farthest person away that I've ever interviewed. I mean, we've gotten Ireland, we've gotten, you know, various other places, but Kazakhstan may be the farthest away. So you're wrapping this semester up.
I am coming to you from practically Siberia.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's exciting. We're making the show international. I kind of dig that. I have in my hand here your new book from Johns Hopkins Press, In Search of Sexual Health, Diagnosing and Treating Syphilis in Hot Springs, Arkansas, 1890-1940. And you begin this book, I was reading in the earlier today in the sort of introductory comments, that syphilis has generally been understood as a taboo subject. And I was curious about why that is, and also why, since that is the case, you were interested in taking this topic on.
Yeah, well, I first got interested in syphilis, which is a strange thing to say, I guess, in a historical sense.
I'm glad it wasn't a personal sense. But okay,
it was not a personal sense. Sometimes after I give lectures on the subject, people come up and they say, "Well, I have this friend," but
I'm asking for a friend.
But I first got into it in grad school when I read Alan Brandt's great book, No Magic Bullet, which is a social history of venereal disease in the US from 1880 to the present. And it came out in the 1980s, which is where you see really the first wave of historical scholarship on syphilis. And a lot of this was directly inspired by the AIDS crisis, which of course is a product of the 1980s as well. And so for the first time, historians started asking questions about, what about sexually transmitted diseases in the past? The kinds of moral attitudes that people used and brought to explaining HIV/AIDS in the 1980s, were they also popping up? Were they also relevant for earlier points in time? And so Alan Brandt's book is really great in the fact that it focuses on the turn of the 20th century, late 1800s, early 1900s, which is this point where the medical profession gets really interested in syphilis. There are all of these bacteriological discoveries happening, all kinds of diagnostic and therapeutic advances. And doctors discover the germ that causes syphilis. They develop new means for treating the disease. And there's this whole discussion about how should society see it? Is it a disease that signifies a person's sexual immorality and should be responded to kind of in a behavioral sense by encouraging them to do things that are more moral, to have a more upright, virtuous lifestyle? Or should it just be seen as a disease that is no different than the common cold that you put on a secular basis and that you treat scientifically without any questions asked about morality? And so the way that kind of Brandt frames the discussion, and a lot of the way that other scholars have too, is that there's this kind of debate between the moralists and the secularists. There's this kind of paradigm in the historical scholarship on syphilis. It's sin versus science. Mm-hmm. And there are these two kind of competing frameworks if you look at the way that people are talking about the disease in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And so that's kind of what drew me in. And in my own research, you know, one of the things that I discovered is that, like a lot of historians do when they look into something quite deeply, is that it's more complicated than that. It's not just that there's the moralists on one hand and the secularists on the other. There's actually a lot of different ways in which these categories for explaining syphilis overlap, and there's intersections. And in my research, I found that this place, Hot Springs, Arkansas, which was a very well-known health resort dating back to the mid-19th century, was one of the places where you could see that doctors are employing both a kind of medical and a moral ideology for understanding and dealing with syphilis. And so that's kind of how I got into it, and how I also discovered that Hot Springs would be an interesting place to kind of have this discussion in a way that was more about what happens to people's bodies. Like, what do they do when they get sick? I'm asking like some very basic questions about medical practice, because that discussion with regard to syphilis, at least, hasn't happened yet in terms of the historical scholarship.
Well, I want to get to the morality. Before we do that, you know that the importance of Hot Springs coincides with an era of what you call incipient health seeking, or the origins of what we might term medical tourism. What do you mean by that exactly?
So the 19th century is a really interesting era because it is one in which, for a great variety of diseases, from tuberculosis mm-hmm. to hay fever, you see that Americans are very much on the move in search of health. And Arkansas is one of those places where, especially after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, in an attempt to rebuild an economy shattered by war, one of the things that local entrepreneurs start turning to is the building up of health resorts and the attempt to attract people from outside the state into Arkansas to be treated for all different kinds of diseases. And of course, the fact that Hot Springs had existed since the 1830s as a place that had been set aside by the federal government for the health and pleasure of the American people really helped them in that sense. Most of the health resorts that historians have talked about are in places like Denver or in California, because the idea is that by traveling to places that have warm, abundant sunshine, or that have healthful atmospheres in terms of like being up in the Rocky Mountains and getting that clean air, are useful for respiratory ailments, particularly tuberculosis. Yeah. So there's a lot of historical scholarship about how health tourism, if you want to call it that, is really one of the big contributing factors to the development of the West. Places like Denver, places like Los Angeles even, places in the Great American Desert like Tucson and Phoenix really grow as cities because they are able to market themselves as effective cures for people who have different kinds of diseases. And what I found interesting in my research is that in Hot Springs, Arkansas, they were doing the same kind of health boosterism, but they weren't talking about any of these other diseases. They were talking about syphilis, which is a much more difficult thing to talk about, given the fact that most people in the 19th century believed that syphilis was, to use the phrase of the time, the wages of sin, something that was a product of sexual immorality. And of course, Arkansas is a really interesting case too, because it has this reputation in the 19th century of being a very unhealthy, unsanitary place. People who go through the area in the 19th century, especially the early 19th century, and they write these kind of travelogues of Arkansas, they say, oh, it's a place that is full of swamps that breed malaria. And it's not a place where anyone would want to go to recover their health. In fact, it's a place where you go to get sick, so avoid it. So after the Civil War, civic boosters in places like Hot Springs really have to work to counteract this idea that Arkansas is an unhealthful place. But they do that, and they do that quite successfully. And in the process, they made Hot Springs into one of the most prominent, highly respected health resorts in the country, all while attracting people with this quote-unquote loathsome, abominable disease of syphilis.
Yeah, it was really fascinating to me how they did that. And it's something really resonated with me too, as a historian who studies Civil War veterans, the idea of, you know, tourism, health-seeking tourism is something that in living in Los Angeles as well. There was a tuberculosis center, you know, for recovery center, as it were, in Pasadena. And then, you know, and so that made a great deal of sense to me. But you mentioned the morality angle. And as I was reading through the chapters, it seems pretty clear that there's a morality issue, that those with the disease were stigmatized in that they were somehow lacking in character. You referred to the wages of sin, the results of sexual immorality. My question is, how did the beliefs about the disease and about morality shape the treatment of the people who suffered from it?
Yeah, this is a great question. And this is one of the kind of bridges that I want to build in the scholarship, because it's been known for a long time. I mentioned Alan Brandt's work before, right? It's been known since the 1980s that Americans in the past had the same kind of negative morality-filled explanations of syphilis that they did of HIV/AIDS, right?
Right.
The question that I'm trying to ask is, okay, like, what was the significance in terms of people who had syphilis? So did that kind of moral framing of the disease impact the way that they understood themselves? Did it impact the kinds of therapeutic strategies that they undertook in the attempt to cure themselves, both physically and mentally? And from the scholarship, a lot of the kind of implication that you sometimes see is that, well, because there was this overarching moral understanding of syphilis, what that meant is that people didn't really put too much emphasis on the curative aspects of it, right? So Alan Brandt, for example, to bring him up again, says, you know, that this is kind of, that therapeutics is a kind of secondary response. It's not really something that people are interested in doing, because they just see it, well, it's, if you got syphilis, it's your fault, and you're condemned to whatever fate God has in store for you, because God created this disease as just punishment for those who commit these kinds of sexual sins. And I'm trying to say, there's definitely that view, and that definitely influences the way that people think about themselves if they contracted syphilis. But was that the end of it? That they just resign themselves to their fate and, you know, quietly disappear without going to doctors, without, you know, seeking out some kind of medical aid? And what I found that, no, that they didn't just sit there and let the disease destroy their bodies. They did things to try to cure themselves. And often they did things that were consistent with this kind of prevailing moral ideology of the disease. And so one of the things that makes Hot Springs so successful as a health resort is that local doctors there, in addition to local businessmen, are able to put forth this idea through various kinds of promotion that Hot Springs is a place created by God for the benefit of his wayward peoples. And there is this kind of religious dimension to the cure in their promotional materials, because they're talking about how the hands of the Almighty shaped the waters specifically for people who are in need of something like forgiveness. And so this kind of spiritual or religious quality of Hot Springs, I think, is part of the reason that it becomes such a popular health resort, because you have people suffering from this disease that is said to be the result of ungodly behavior attracted to a place that offers a divinely inspired cure for them of both the mind and the body, right? So that's just kind of one instance in where you can see morality and medicine not necessarily being distinct things, but overlapping in a very real way. Like, people aren't just allowing the disease to destroy them, but they are seeking a cure that is consistent with this idea that syphilis is the wages of sin. Right, there is this sense that they need to be forgiven, and that in part draws them to Hot Springs.
Now, those that are providing the treatment, is there a racial, like a race, a class, a gender angle that we can that can help us understand this? Is there a different approach depending on these different variables?
Definitely. You know, with regard to the historical scholarship on syphilis, one of the other things that I'm trying to do in the book is expand the cast of characters in our historical narrative of this disease, because for good reasons, for example, things like the Tuskegee syphilis study, there is a lot of great historical scholarship that deals with the racial dimensions of syphilis in the late 19th, early 20th century US. So you have lots of studies that focus specifically on African Americans and the way that syphilis is often said to be a disease of Black people, who associated in the medical literature with all of these different kinds of immorality, or what doctors would even say, amorality. And building on that, what I'm trying to kind of bring to the table here is a recognition that despite the fact that there is this association of Blackness and syphilis, it's not, we don't have to kind of repeat the implication of this primary source material by only studying African Americans, right? Yeah. So what I'm kind of trying to do in the study is say, okay, but who else? Who else is actually getting this disease? And what impact do these racial attitudes around syphilis have on the way that they themselves seek out care? And so a part of the book is actually talking about the experience of people who are not really discussed at any length in the existing literature, which is white men, particularly white men of privilege. And what I want to show in the book is that when you look at the way that doctors interacted with this particular group of patients, there are lots of differences. There are a lot of extra measures taken to ensure that the bodies of white male syphilitics are cared for in a way that is not often provided for other kinds of syphilitic patients, notably Black men and Black women. So for example, in this chapter of the book where I talk about the moral dimensions of cure and this program of kind of like moral treatment that doctors in Hot Springs made available to their patients, right, part of this regimen of moral therapy is about recognizing that there is a way for white patients to acknowledge the guilt and the anxiety and the shame that they must be feeling after having contracted syphilis because they have a moral conscience. And interestingly, that program of moral therapy, which has to do with things like abstaining from alcohol, not engaging in any sexual indulgences, not doing anything that is kind of a vice. That program of moral therapy is not extended to African-American patients because they are not believed capable of being guilty, of feeling any shame at their action. So in some ways, the is about maintaining that racial boundary in the way people think about this is a way of saying, well, for white patients, we're going to do something totally different. And that is a kind of theme that runs throughout the book, because you see it expressed not only in this period, the early kind of stages of Hot Springs existence, but through the 1920s and the 1930s as well, where there are different standards of care and there are different outcomes for patients that are differentiated on the basis of race.
It's fascinating. Let's talk about the treatment. What's the science that's going on here, and how much of this is maybe a little bit shady?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, one question that I get asked a lot when I talk about Hot Springs is, well, like, did it work?
Yeah, right. Did
the cure that they offered there actually improve patients' bodily states? Did it give them any kind of cure? Was it a scientifically, justifiable practice? So the cure that doctors administered to their patients in hot springs made, of course, heavy use of the hot springs themselves, right? So bathing in these waters was a regular part of the therapy. And the way that doctors did this was to combine daily trips to the bathhouse with injections of mercury, which is a toxic chemical compound. But from the 16th century forward had been the predominant medical response to syphilis. And so the doctors of Hot Springs develop this kind of combination therapy wherein, in the bathhouses, there are people, bathhouse attendants, employed to rub mercury, ointments of mercury, into patients' backs. This on a daily basis over the course of several weeks and even months, combining that with the baths, which the idea is that by bathing in these near boiling waters, you can sweat out a lot of the toxins, not just the toxins from mercury itself, which is poisonous, obviously, but also the toxins of syphilis itself, which is just beginning to be understood as a disease caused by a specific form of bacteria. Is that a scientifically valid or justifiable treatment? I don't know, right? Looking at the medical literature, what I can say is that often people felt like the symptoms of syphilis were being alleviated through the combination of mercury treatment and bathing. So did it work in terms of destroying the bacteria? No. Did it work in terms of making syphilitic patients feel a little bit better on a day-to-day basis? Probably yes. But there are also lots of cases where patients feel all right. They spend some time in hot springs. They go back home. And then 6 months later, they come back in hot springs. They have to keep coming back year after year. And some of these health seekers actually die while in hot springs receiving treatment. In fact, in the book, I talk about two individual cases of patients whose letters and correspondence I was able to track down. And one of them apparently died by suicide because he could not stand the strain of both the treatment and of knowing that he had syphilis. And another patient who spent 13 months in hot springs and eventually resigned himself to the fact that he wasn't going to get better, that his disease had progressed to a point where there was nothing really that medicine or science could do from him or for him. And he spent his last days in hot springs living as well as he could. One of the interesting things that I found kind of studying this community of health seekers, this group of syphilitics in hot springs, is that in the process of getting to know each other and caring for each other, because that's often what happened, you have patients administering daily care to each other, not so much in terms of medicine, but just in terms of moral support and taking care of each other's day-to-day physical needs. A lot of these individuals, they're able to create this destigmatized environment, right? Because you realize that there are people around you that are similarly unlucky in having contracted this virus. And they come to realize it's not because we were bad people who did something that was immoral. It's just that we're a group of unfortunates and society has unjustly branded us with this label of immorality. But that doesn't have to be the way that we think about this ourselves in the way that you know, we try to take care of each other. So Hot Springs itself, actually, when you look at the kind of patient community that develops there, it does become this interesting destigmatized environment where people, you know, are able to form friendships, sometimes lasting bonds with other patients. Again, they don't just wither away physically or psychologically. psychologically, they continued to have a strong inner life that was rich and that was filled with lots of experiences like entertainment, friendship, caring for each other. And that, I think, over time kind of contributed to perhaps the slow disappearance of this kind of moral attitude around syphilis.
The fact that you can capture that that sentiment to me, I found quite fascinating. One of the things I wanted to ask you, this is a great opening into this question, is that I was wondering how the patients themselves understood their disease, how much they knew about it, and really, how did you capture their voices? As historians, we have to go into the historical record and we have to unpack these things. And sometimes we ask questions that lead us to dead ends. These are things that I talk to my students about all the time. You have the questions and you go to the historical record and you run up against roadblocks and brick walls and various other things, and you can't capture the voices that you would like. But you seem to capture the voices. You mentioned the two specifically that I remember quite well from the book. But as far as others, you know, how do you go about getting all this information?
Yeah, that's a really great question. When I began this study back in graduate school, shortly after discovering that Hot Springs was this kind of mecca for syphilitic patients, I had started finding some primary source material, but it was all medical literature. There was a local medical society within Hot Springs, and they had a journal where resident physicians published papers. Lots of them dealt with syphilis. And I said to myself, okay, great. At least I've got something that I can work off. I can talk about doctors and the way that they developed an understanding of syphilis. I can talk about doctors in terms of the way that they diagnosed patients, or if they talked about different kinds of cures that they used, their development of this unique Hot Springs method of treating syphilis. But for a while, I thought that that's really all I would have. And I thought that this would be kind of a physician-centered study, which would be fine, but not ultimately as satisfying as I had hoped. But then as I got into the research more, particularly after visiting Hot Springs itself, I found that it was actually possible to write a more patient-centered story. And this is where things really got fascinating for me. I can remember one day when I was in Hot Springs doing my dissertation research, and I went to the local historical society, the Garland County Historical Society, and I told them about my research. And I said, I'm just wondering if there are any interesting materials here that I might be able to look at that can help me understand this in a little bit more detail. And on my second day, I think it was, in the office of the local historical society, the head researcher there, an archivist named Liz Robbins, came up to me and said, oh, by the way, a while ago, somebody came by and dropped off these letters. You might want to take a look at them. I haven't seen them myself, but you never know what you'll find, right? And so I said, okay, not expecting much. I'll take a look at it. It might provide some useful contextual information. Wasn't expecting much. And lo and behold, what I find is this correspondence of an individual who traveled to Hot Springs first in 1905 and then again in 1907, and who actually had syphilis throughout this time period. And he never talks about the disease explicitly. He says, for example, that he has the disease, and I remember this phrase sticks in my mind, the disease that is born of the bitterness of the prostitute. That's how he explains it. But he talks about what syphilis is doing to his body as the treatment that he's taking is unable to really reverse the biological deterioration that he's experiencing. And there are some really, really gruesome passages in his diary. He talks about, for example, how his body feels like rats that are gnawing a corpse. He starts contemplating that at some point he will just be an undifferentiated mass buried in a grave somewhere. He talks about how his nose starts falling to pieces and is just eaten away by the disease. So a lot of that is really hard to read. But at the same time, as someone who's really interested in figuring out not just how doctors saw things, but how individuals themselves with syphilis saw this disease, it was really fascinating to run across across those kinds of sources. And they did allow me kind of a different window onto this disease. And I was fortunate not enough to not only to find firsthand travel accounts like that of people who went to hot springs, but also I was able to find clinical case files of patients who were treated in hot springs for syphilis, in particular military veterans and current soldiers who went to the Hot Springs General Army and Navy Hospital, which was created in 1884, specifically to be treated for syphilis. And this was also a very surprising find for me, because I think for a long time in the historical scholarship, the assumption has been, well, syphilis was this taboo disease. You're not going to really find references to it in hospital records because doctors would not actually write that down as a cause of someone's death or as a diagnosis that was given. And quite the contrary, I found that at least as far as this one military hospital in Hot Springs goes, that doctors were quite willing to do those things. And they openly treated patients for syphilis. So with those kinds of records, I hope that I was able to give a sense of what it looked like from the patient's perspective in a way that kind of shines new light on this disease and its meaning in the time period that I'm considering for the book.
Well, I certainly think you did. You also mentioned the Army and Navy here, and there's a government angle to this also that I wanted to discuss with you. The treatment clinic operated by the United States Public Health Service. I was wondering what the official government position is on public health and the general welfare of the citizenry, and if they also assume some of these sort of racial attitudes that you mentioned earlier in terms of treatment and various other things.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, for the most part in the book, I'm kind of trying to push back against this idea that syphilis is only something that happens in wartime, that syphilis fundamentally concerns the state and the public health apparatus of the state by saying, no, like syphilis is more or less an always present disease. Doctors deal with it in addition to military commanders, in addition to members of the public health service. But at some point you have to acknowledge that governments do matter. And this is particularly the case in Hot Springs, where after World War I, the federal government establishes the first federally operated free venereal disease public health clinic anywhere in the country. It was established in 1921, and it operated through World War II. It was a place where people from all across the United States could go to be treated for syphilis or gonorrhea for free, without charge. And over the course of the time period that I looked at, the 1920s and 1930s, there are at least 60,000 or so individuals, rich, poor, black, white, men, women, children, who go there to be treated for syphilis. So the government inserts itself in a very powerful way in the story of Hot Springs' response to syphilis after World War I, and that really brings things to a different level. One of the interesting things that I found while researching the Public Health Service VD clinic in Hot Springs is that, as I said, while there are no restrictions on people, on the kinds of people that could receive treatment there, the outcomes varied quite a lot. If you look at some of the demographic statistics that the head of the clinic generated and sent off to his superiors in Washington, it's clear that on average, white patients stayed in Hot Springs longer, received more injections of mercury and Salvarsan, which was a newer, also toxic arsenical compound developed for syphilis in 1910. And generally, these white patients met with better outcomes than black patients. And part of the reason for this is that in the Great Depression, the 1930s, there were lots and lots of people applying for aid at this clinic in Hot Springs. And eventually what the government decided to do was build a transient relief center, a camp that was located on the outskirts of the city where people would be housed freely and provided food and shelter and other forms of basic domestic care on the taxpayer's dollar. And this camp, which is a place called Camp Garaday, it operated from 1935 into 1937. And interestingly, it was only open to white, unmarried men. The government had another program that was designed to provide funding to Black patients, men and women, and also white women in Hot Springs, who had to arrange room and board for themselves in a hotel within Hot Springs. And they paid for those things, but they were basically left to themselves. This one group, white unmarried men, was singled out for privileged treatment and placed in this government-run camp where they had all of their day-to-day needs provided for, in addition to the medical treatment that they were receiving for syphilis. And it's not surprising that this thing kind of existed. The director of the Hot Springs Clinic was an individual named Oliver Wenger, who is known primarily for his later involvement in the Tuskegee syphilis study, which started in 1932, so just about a decade after the Hot Springs VD clinic was created. And as lots of historians have noted, in looking at him, he is definitely someone who views syphilis through a racial prism. He has a kind of eugenic understanding of this disease, and he is most concerned with taking care of people like him, that is, white men with syphilis. And so, as I said before, kind of the racial divergence in therapeutic outcomes is something that continues through the 1930s and can be seen when the state actively intervenes in Hot Springs to provide for care of syphilitic patients.
You note, since in the lead up to World War II here, you note in the aftermath of the Great War, World War I, that a number of leading Western intellectuals developed a profound skepticism towards science and medicine. The cost of technological progress, for example, outweighed the benefits. Can you explain that?
Sure. So one of the things that generates all of this skepticism coming out of World War I is the influenza pandemic of 1918-1919, which killed in 1 year more people than 4 years of military conflict had killed, and which was caused by something, a virus, that medical science had no knowledge of at the time. And so for medical professions around the world, the influenza pandemic and its aftermath is a real period of crisis. Doctors couldn't understand the disease. They couldn't treat it. They couldn't come up with any effective solutions to it whatsoever. And what this results in after the war in the 1920s is this big rethinking of Western medicine, which many doctors come to believe is too reductionist, too narrow in its understanding of health and illness. And what emerges out of that, for the first time, you get people talking about the concept of medical holism. The idea that in order to treat a patient's illness, you have to treat not just the isolated problem in their body, but the whole body, which includes the patient's psyche, their mental state as well. So holism becomes one of the big kind of countercultural movements in medicine during the 1920s. And physicians within Hot Springs are contributing to these holistic developments by promoting the idea that the regular consumption of water, in addition to, you know, bathing in water, is one of the things that helps people, not just in a preventative sense, but also in a curative sense. And local resident physicians kind of latch on to this, these holistic currents in medicine and use it and turn it kind of toward promotional ends, right? They start picking up on this idea that nature, right, because hot springs is a naturally existing phenomenon, mm-hmm. that nature has provided the cures for humanity that medical science cannot. Mm. And all throughout the 1920s and 30s, this becomes a fairly successful business model for doctors in hot springs to rely on, because at the same time that they're saying these things, medical science is developing new and better cures for syphilis. A while ago, I mentioned this drug called Salvarsan, which mm-hmm. is an arsenical compound developed in 1910. And it's clear that as this more advanced remedy for syphilis became more widely used, there was a corresponding decline in the number of people coming to hot springs. Eventually, medical tourism, as it existed in this period of time, is completely wiped out and destroyed with the antibiotic revolution after World War II, when we see the emergence of these wonder drugs like penicillin. But for the 1920s and 30s, in response to the appearance of a more effective remedy for syphilis, doctors start saying, in keeping with the kind of holistic trends of the era, that actually medical science doesn't offer the best means of cure. Actually, what we need is to turn to nature.
That's really fascinating. In fact, I see some, reverberations of that sometimes today, which leads me to the final question that I wanted to ask you. And I know that the circumstances are entirely different and the contexts are entirely different, but something came up and it just made me think of this. We are in the midst of a public health crisis right now, a worldwide pandemic. Much like the pandemic of 1918, 1919 on that scale, perhaps. I'm wondering if your work can help us understand how we as a people might respond to a health crisis like this.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, of course, I'm talking about an era in which travel was regularly advised and undertaken for its health-giving properties. Mm-hmm. And many of the people that I talk about in Hot Springs, the act of going to a different place where nobody knew you provided a form of psychological relief, if nothing else, that was not available to you by staying at home among family members in a broader community who might have known that you had this disease that was not just deadly, but also thought to be the result of immoral behavior. So one of the kind of lessons, I suppose, of hot springs, if there is one, is that in an era where governments all around the world are making it harder for people to travel from place to place or country to country in search of medical assistance, perhaps we should recognize that that is something that is generally beneficial for people, not just for financial reasons, not just for reasons of physical health, but also mental health. Mm-hmm. But of course, now we live in this era when we cannot travel. And I don't really know if there are things that we can learn from hot springs that would help us in this era of physical distancing and isolation. But I think at least it does remind us that the kinds of impacts that forced isolation can have are pretty severe, and in some cases may be even worse than whatever disease we're dealing with. I'm not saying that as a result of this finding that we shouldn't practice physical distancing. In fact, I think the evidence shows that those kinds of practices, even extending to mandatory mask orders and lockdowns, are pretty effective in terms of containing a virus like COVID-19. But nonetheless, we do also have to attend to the fact that for long periods of time, people have used travel as a way to feel better about themselves physically and mentally. And perhaps there is some virtual equivalent of that, that societies and governments will need to develop an acknowledgement of the fact that being stuck in one place, whether you're sick or healthy, can have some pretty damaging impacts. I don't know how satisfying that is as an attempt to draw parallels between the period that I'm talking about and the current pandemic. The thing that I was most fortunate about in writing this book is that it was published really just as the pandemic was coming upon us. You know, like I never, and in the writing stages, I never had to think about how is this relevant with regard to COVID-19, because the pandemic hadn't happened yet.
Right.
I think in some ways this might be a different book if I was still working on it right now with everything that's happening. But you know, the things that I've learned about with regard to health seeking and medical tourism just remind me of perhaps how difficult it is to do the things that are being required of us right now in this age of COVID-19.
Well, I tell you, if anything, it would make a really interesting coda to the second edition when this comes out. Elliot, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you. The book is In Search of Sexual Health, Diagnosing and Treating Syphilis in Hot Springs, Arkansas, 1890 to 1940. It is new from Johns Hopkins Press. Buy it, read it, and we can talk more about it in the future. Thanks again for coming on the show, man.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Keith. You've got a great podcast. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much. All right, man. Take it easy.
All right. Take care.